Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them. And if you use the code PITCH, P-I-T-C-H, you can receive up to 10% off your next order. Ever tried watching your athlete's game from anywhere in the world? With Replayer, you actually can. I had a friend watch his son's game live from his flight. My son watched a live game from the car while we were driving up the California coast. It doesn't matter where you are, grandparents across the country, cousins on the other side of the world, teammates who just moved away, set up the camera, hit go live, and everyone with a link is right there on the sideline. Live streaming is free. Unlimited games, unlimited teams, unlimited users. No complex tiers. Everyone gets access. And forget waiting hours for footage. I recorded a 60-minute game, and it was ready in 5 minutes. Players were clipping highlights on the ride home. One camera, made in the USA, unlimited everything. If you never want to miss those moments, head to replayer.com. The link is in the show notes. Hello and welcome back to Chat by the Pitch. This is Ian Babcock, your host. Today I am joined by Ray Power. This conversation dives deep into youth development, coaching philosophy, and why parents understanding the process matters just as much as the player and the coaches on the field. We talk about building a better environment for kids, keeping players in love with the game, and why development should always matter more than short-term results. Let's start this chat and head to the pitch.
Yeah, hi there. My name is Ray Power. I am almost 20 years now working in youth development, football, soccer development, professional football, soccer / coach development. So a long and winding career that I guess has taken me around the world physically, but also for little journeys like this where we can talk across continents around football. Probably sparked in 2014 when I had a book called Making the Ball Roll released. I think that's the kind of ground zero for people who may or may not have come across my stuff before through social and coach education and things like that. Yeah, I've probably just about seen it all, I think.
I love it. So let's start off with you as a soccer player and your journey. So where did you begin playing football, and when was the first, I'll start off with your first memory playing, because I think this is a cool story. These are cool stories to share.
Yeah, my first memory of playing is the fact that I don't have one, because I was always playing, if that makes sense. So every room had a ball. Every room had a different goalpost, whether that was the door to the next room or whether it was the legs of the table or the end of the bed or the garage door outside or the wall at the other side of the house. So I was, yes, I have a four-year-old boy at the moment who I look at him and I see me all those years ago, just obsessed with the ball, wanting to play with it, wanting to watch it, wanting to get around it as much as I could, understand the songs and the what's going on in the world of football. So it was all consuming and has pretty much remained so for 40 years plus. I peaked when I was about 15, I would say. I was playing adult football at 15 as a reasonable local level, still with aspirations of playing at my age group at a higher level, which really, and just honestly, just ended up probably petering away because of ability, but also life and taking me in different directions and school, and eventually went to university and all that. And it was in my early 20s that it went from being a recreational footballer, recreational soccer player to a coach.
Okay, so what made you dive into coaching? I've interviewed a lot of coaches over the years now, and some of them start off at 16, 17 years old coaching to not getting into it until they're in their 30s and realizing this is what my passion is, my love is, and I don't know why I waited so long to get into it. So how did you get into coaching?
I grew up in Ireland, and at the time when I left school at the turn of the century, I live in the UK now, and I have done for the most part for the last probably 15 or 20 years. In Ireland at that time, you didn't go to a career guidance teacher and decide you were going to go study sport or coaching or stuff like that. You could be a PE teacher. Otherwise, you had to do things that were normal, so to speak. So it was never really on my radar to coach until, I guess, I became a teacher. Did a degree, became a school teacher, like shirt and tie in a classroom, moved abroad to do that and going, oh, I really don't like this. I don't like this at all. And don't get me wrong, I worked in a really nice school. The conditions were really nothing like the worst school system at all. But I just didn't like it. I waited for Friday. I waited for the football on Saturday. I waited for the term holidays and things like that. And I did have a bit of a moment, even in my early 20s, where I'm like, am I really going to just wish my life away? Or what gets me out of bed in the morning? And I quickly landed on, we're all coaches, aren't we? In a certain respect, we all think we are at a certain level. So I said, look, if this is what occupies my mind and my thinking and all that, then let's go and let's do it. So started getting called, looked for a job in football. It ended up the first one being in community coaching, like most people. And then little by little, it snowballs over time. You get more qualified, you get a better job, you get more qualified, you get a better job. And lots of peaks and troughs in between. That was my motivation. And it doesn't sound very, hopefully by the end of the call, people don't think every decision I made was purely about me. But those early ones, it was like, I've got to map this out right for myself. So yeah, quite ego-driven probably in those early days.
I don't know if it's ego-driven, or I think what we teach kids today, at least here in the United States, we teach them to follow their passion, their love, their drive. Because if you're doing that, they always say you're never working a day in your life. And I think you do want to advance. I don't care if you're in the office and I work a 9-to-5. I'm a data analyst is my day job. And you do have to chase something that pushes you and motivates you and something you love and enjoy otherwise.
And it was pretty stark. Really do remember the moment where I'm lying there going, look, Ray, you're either going to do this or you're not. Or you're either going to find yourself in a few years still not liking what you're doing every day. And I don't know, that kind of idea always, I understand what you're saying, but it always unsettled me a little bit because I was rejecting normality and what a lot of other people do. Because shock horror, I didn't like my job. I liked my job looking back, if that makes sense. I just didn't like it. Yesterday was fun, but tomorrow I don't want to go. So yeah, football, I just became that four-year-old again, kicking a ball around whatever room. It was just like, what's my new room and what's my new role in that room? Yeah, and haven't looked back really.
Love it. So let's start talking about, I know you have a good book. I actually read it out of curiosity. Obviously I'm interviewing you, but I came across you in a different manner than your book. And after doing research on you, I did read it. I went into my little log of books to read and I really enjoyed it. So where did you start curating your philosophy on coaching and in the environments that have shaped who you are and your philosophy today? Because that's a huge step. Because
that's it. Yeah, that's a better question than you probably think it is. Because when in the early part of my journey, I was getting qualified and I was doing okay. And I had huge ambition, still in my probably, I don't know, mid-20s or something like that. And I arranged a meeting with someone here at the FA in England. Just, I don't know if you want to call it a mentor type meeting. It wasn't intended to be anything like that. It was just like, here's me, here's what I am. What do I need? And he gave me some feedback, which led to me starting a document, literally a PowerPoint document where I was dumping. This was before Dropbox and mass amount of documents. So anything I could find, anything that was interesting, anything I could make a note of, literally a sort of a professional coaching scrapbook went into this document. And obviously, the more you do that, then the more you have to divide it up into chapters. And suddenly it was starting to form this piece of work. And at the same time, running parallel, I had this, always had the idea of writing a book, parked in the corner of my mind somewhere, not really giving it much thought. And then the ideas joined forces. I had all this material. I had all this really strong ideas forming together. So then, again, probably put it into action. Those probably moments of action are the bits that you become really proud of, because you turned something you thought of or idealized into something real. So yeah, which led to the book. So the I think your if the conversation then is bit, it's about coaching style and influences and things like that. I think everything, whether it's good or bad, or all your experiences kind of form together who you listen to, what you read, all that sort of thing gives you, I don't know, a football coaching version of you that it should always be malleable over time, but forms probably 80 or 90% quite strongly after a period of time. And I found my corner in either youth player development or coach development, or both, really. Yeah, so that was a kind of a whistle-stop tour of that process. So it, quite a few things aligned together that resulted in, yeah, my both my coaching philosophy forming, but also my book forming at the same time, the first book.
I find it fascinating because I like how you talked about having a drop, like before the drop block, you're just dropping it into a PowerPoint presentation and learning. If you're doing it that way, you're constantly, I'm assuming you're constantly rereading everything you're coming across, because in a PowerPoint, you have to go back to, depending on what stage, I remember when I had a PowerPoint, it wouldn't save where the last spot, you'd have to start at the beginning every time you opened up the document and go to where you left off. And today, now it just starts where you left off. Yeah. And I'm assuming you reviewed your work all the time, the things you were finding. So the philosophy, from the sounds of it, started to get ingrained in you learning.
Yeah, I guess so. And like the moments I love to be fair in are the ones where what's already in that folder is starts to be challenged, just starts to be pushed a little bit. And what writing a book does for you, it's very hard, especially with your first book. I'm probably more forthright these days than I was then. With my first book, I wanted to be sure to present, not all the ideas, that's silly, but to present the pros and cons, let's say, of A, and just to give it some sort of balance, things like that. So when something did come in and it did push those boundaries, I've always been quite open to those. I would say I've enjoyed that kind of, to the coaches I work with now, I would always talk about less, let the new idea wrestle around inside your head. And if you don't like something new, but you've given it time to live and breathe, and you still don't like it, then you're solid. You can throw that away. It might well make a difference. It might well make a change in you. And I think if we look at, even if we look at the top, top coaches in the world, the professional ones, they change, they evolve. So it only seems right, the game evolves. It only seems right that we at least stay attuned to that rather than just let us grow and surpass us just because we've planted a flag in the sand.
So as you've gone through all this, you talked about growing, evolving, letting things settle and pushing things aside. If it doesn't match what you're looking for, how do you think, when you're starting to get into this teaching side of everything, how has that played an effect with the advice you give? Because I have sat through I sat through your coursework that you've done. And to me as a parent, I wish we had this for us as parents. I think it's instrumental because I guess maybe I'm a little bit different than a lot of parents. I like to learn. I like to understand, especially what my kids will be going through and doing. If they had this for gymnastics, I think I'd enjoy it just as much for my daughter. It's so fascinating because you go through all these different things and you bring up different topics and you have all these different guests when you do this coaching curriculum that you have. And how do you think you, and I have to pause and gather my thoughts. No. When you have all these thoughts and all these ideas and you're starting to explain to push them aside or to have them develop into who you are, how did you figure this out as an individual that these were the things that you needed to focus on? Because coming from the coaching perspective, coming from the education side, I feel like you had the leg up because I think most great coaches are some of the best educators out there.
Yeah, I think you might be right. And I think it was like, no matter where you go, if you go to learn anything, the first thing people probably tell you is to be open-minded. So just try to listen to that first. And what I want to be really clear with the people who are listening to your stuff, that I will not throw something, if I hear something new or there's something different than what I think presented, throwing it away out of hand is very different than throwing it away once you've given it time. So that in itself is a form of learning. You've not learned anything new, but you've strengthened what you have. So maybe that all does sound very academic, doesn't it? Unintentionally, probably. But I just, I don't know, maybe I have a bit of a thing about stepping into other people's shoes. And it's really difficult if there's 100 coaches picking up a coaching course I run. It's very difficult to step into 100 pairs of shoes because everything will land no matter what. If you have a 1-hour lecture on football coaching or anything else, things are going to land differently from number 1 to 100 for sure. So that led me to think, well, actually, if I'm in that audience and if what lands with me is different than what lands with you, Ian, then that's unique in itself. So in fact, it's not 1 to 100, it's 1 to 100 times over. So the message became, lean into your light bulb moments, your pieces of learning. And you know them because of the, just listen to this podcast. It'll be the part that will stick out in your mind where you go, ah, I need to Google this when I'm off the call, or I need to read that book, or I need to find out more about that. I need to watch that game. So I was always a great believer in leaning into that because you tapped into something, probably the most important part of when you spoke about parents, the most important part of what you're trying to do with your kids' sport, and you talked about gymnastics, the most important part is that you're motivated. You're a motivated learner, right? Now, the same kid that's motivated to come to my soccer sessions is not motivated to go to his math lesson. So he would, right? He would listen to me and theoretically learn more and do all that than with his math teacher. He's a different kid for me. And that's probably the kind of the cool part about being a sports coach to kids sometimes. Now, I know you often talk about your frustration with parents and I wish we had this for parents. We could have it for parents, but it doesn't mean it would land en masse. It will land with a few and it might move a needle and with some. Because I also know I've been the dad in a WhatsApp group for scouts, rock climbing, whatever other recreational stuff your kids do, that, oh, there's a few messages in the rock climbing group. I'll pick them up tomorrow. It'll be about a form or it'll be, because I just want to drop my kid there on Saturday morning, make sure they have a good hour and then bring them home. I just need to know where I need to be and when. I don't really need to know. And that's just parents for you. Now, probably where soccer doesn't quite hit the spot is that the biggest frustration for many coaches is that a lot of parents will arrive without the motivation to learn, but with a lot of volume and a lot of contribution to make, particularly on match days. And outcomes of match days tend to, just like in professional sports, the outcome of what happens on a Saturday or Sunday becomes either a stick to beat you with or something to be triumphant with instead. Yeah, and that's, and you know what? A lot of that, I think, is potentially because parents, when people go to sporting events, they go, this is what I do when I go to a game of soccer, or this is what I see on TV when I see a game of soccer or a college basketball game. We get excited, we hurl abuse at the referee, we scream for our kid, we shout instructions, the coach should be shouting because this is what society has told us coaching is, and us inside the tent, no, it's not. Or most of us inside the tent, no, it's not. But yeah, there lies a big old jumble of a problem.
Interesting, because I talk to so many coaches and I've learned there's three types of coaches, I feel like. There's the what we call an American football coach, which is constantly screaming, constantly yelling, constantly berating the players to get the most out of them. There is the hybrid in between, and then I call it the professional coach. And I'll probably get a lot of flack from this. They scream and yell at practice all day, have high expectations in practice, and then they have, then at match day, they sit back, they give a little comments here and there, but they don't coach. They aren't like, I can't think of his name. He was Manchester United coach.
Alex Ferguson.
I'm drawing.
Sir Alex Ferguson.
Yeah, Sir Alex Ferguson. He knew when he stood up, you did something wrong. And, or if he did a certain body movement, you were in trouble. But he didn't coach during the game. He sat back and watched. And then maybe gave instructions. Compared to Pep today, Pep is nonstop pointing directions, arm flailing, constantly yelling. And I remember hearing an interview and someone asked, do you hear your coach? And hearing Pep, they go, if I'm on the other side of the field, I don't hear a word he says. And I really, like, really made me think long and hard. And then I had a coach that I'm good friends with here, and I really respect what he said to me. And he's more like Sir Alex Ferguson. He goes, I'll ride him all practice. I'll yell at him all in practice. I'll motivate them in practice, but when it comes to game day, my job is to make sure they don't get yellow cards and to be their cheerleader.
Yeah.
And he goes, it's to control the, I can't go, everything I've taught them, the game day's test day. And granted, he is coaching U17s and U19s, but I really think about it. I look at a lot of the sidelines, like my daughter, coach. She's the right coach for my daughter because she gets on my daughter when she doesn't do the right thing. And that's what I feel like you need to do it at the right age. But she's not doing it out of being mean. She's doing it because she knows the kids know better. And if they need to have a conversation, she'll yank them off and have a conversation with them. But she's not berating them. I guess her own child. But that's the hard thing of coaching your own kids, because you expect certain things out of your own child more than you expect out of other people. But I look at the different style of coaching, and I think every age group is different and the instructions matter. I don't commit to something half-heartedly. That's how I got into coaching. It was, I volunteered to be assistant. Then all the next thing I know, I'm spending 40 hours a week learning how to coach a bunch of 6-year-olds, because I'm not doing give them a half-hearted answer. I want to make sure I can give them the best answer. And I think as parents, when our kids truly love something, and it might take them until they're 10 years old to figure it out.
Yeah, true. That last bit was laced with different levels of stuff. To be honest, match day being an extension of a training program or the test of it is probably the best way I've heard it described. So if you have to walk players through a game of soccer at the weekend, you've probably missed some stuff off your training schedule the week before. And then we can have this whole conversation about what is the value of the training sessions you do. Is it what we call here line drills or constant drills, where you just, kids are stood in a queue for a half an hour, or they're doing physical work when, you know, it's not optimal for their bodies, all that kind of stuff. And then come match day, because everyone feels a sense of pressure, particularly the coach, ego kicks in, coaches always feel like the eyes of the parents are on them. And it can all turn a little bit toxic. My attitude would be, do your coaching with the players in your coaching sessions. I work to a curriculum. I have done for 15 years, regardless of how long I've been in football, soccer, regardless of the environment or country I've been in, because why wouldn't I? Why would I just haphazard my way around a football training program? You wouldn't allow a swim coach to do it, or a golf coach, would you? You'd probably have them say, oh, for the next 6 weeks, we're going to, I don't know, deep dive this idea, or the next, by the end of this year, your kid will be able to do the front stroke, the back stroke, the blah, blah, blah. That's quite normal. And maybe that's an individual sport thing, but I think in a team sport thing, having markers, or at least having some guide to pull a game of football, soccer, which is vast, it is vast, to pull all the different elements of the game through in an age-appropriate way, so that on match day, you can, in my eyes, sit back and remind. I like the word remind on a match day. Most of the things you should say, unless something really weird comes up, most of the things that you should be saying should be reminders or little hints or little questions or dropping it in, or maybe something, things that are individual, rather than a full volume joystick coaching, as we call it, or just trying to move pieces around the chessboard. The Guardiola, in many ways, Pep Guardiola is the standard bearer for youth coaches, because he gave people, if he can be brave enough to play from the goalkeeper 3 yards to the centre back against Real Madrid, then we can have our players take the ball under pressure on a Sunday morning. But in many other ways, he does have that kind of move every chess piece part of him. That's probably not ideal. But he's working in the professional game. He's got to win leagues, and it's different.
As a parent, I think you touched on something about, I wish I would have wrote it down fast enough, but it's talking more about how what's the word I'm looking for? Showing up and doing, the kids showing up. I think I'm going to start off with that. When you said, like, you have, when the players show up and you're missing something, if they aren't getting it in game day, and then you have to give them guidance, I think there's a huge difference. I think we as parents go into the mindset, and especially here in America with, we'll call it football because that's what it's called there, with football, it is, don't understand it. We're finally getting the first generation, maybe the second generation of parents that played. Maybe not even at a high level, but at least in high school. My son will be the first generation, same with my daughter, that played the game. I never played the game. We're starting to get to the point where the generations coming up are more familiar with the game. And so I think there is a higher expectation, but we also have American-style coaching that doesn't back up the rest of the world. And the more I spent time, I did all my what we call grassroots coaching here. It's learning the different 4v4, 7v7, 9v9, and 11v11. And it's a very high level, and I was getting ready to sit for my D license. Everything imploded in my coaching life at the time. And as a parent, I realized there's a few things that I messed up, and it was I didn't listen. And listening's not so much with my ears, but my eyes. It was watching how the players reacted, watching how the players moved, and not basing things based off that. I was listening to parents. I was listening to other people and not paying attention with my eyes. And that was the big difference as a parent. It's now when I go out and watch my son play, I don't get mad about his technical skills. I care about his hustles because I always tell everyone, I say this all the time, he has more talent in his little piggy toe than I have in my whole body when it comes to this game. Same with my daughter. She's no different now. And she's 8 and he's 12. And I look at it from that perspective. Only thing I can tell them they can control now is how hard they work. It's like our job is not to educate them. That's why we hire a coach. That's why we have a coach.
Yeah, I would go a step further, Ian, and go the role of the parent in all this. And I class myself as a parent, a football parent as well, is do not ruin it for them. Do not ruin. And I don't mean like the game or the session. Don't ruin the love. Don't get away. I could use your word, hustle my 4-year-old into drills and ladders and cones and stuff like that out the back and just kill the joy in it. Or when he goes, Dad, can we go outside? I'll go. And what do you want to do? We'll do X, Y, or Z and just keep the fire burning. If we could get out of the way of kids falling out of love with the game, then to me, anything after that, it will just run its course. Good coaches will come, bad coaches will come. Every single professional footballer you see will have had both. But they will have had coaches that are bad, but they love because of some personable reasons, or coaches that were really good that they'll hate because whatever, they held them to a standard they couldn't maintain. It doesn't matter. Really, if I had a choice for my boy now, from 4 to 18, let's say, for the next 14 years, I would want him to meet every cross-section of coaching situation, within reason, every coaching situation he can find. So the one that will play him every week, the one that won't, the one that will give him a hard time, the one that will play him in his favourite position every time he plays, the one who won't, you know what I mean? And just give him the ups and downs that you need. And look, obviously then with time on the grass and love of the game and all that kind of stuff, you just hope that it's not a formula, it's just loads of stuff thrown into a pot that'll be, yeah, ultimately it'll take him to whatever will be the best version of him over time.
I don't know where I wrote it, but I say we suck the fun out of it. Parents suck the fun out of everything. We want our players to be professionals. Like I said, all I care about is my son working hard. That's the only factor he can control on that pitch. And so if I'm telling him he's not shooting well enough, I'm telling him all this stuff, I'm not going to drive that wedge into him that he's never good enough. Because at the end of the day, I tell him, if you start talking to pro athletes, who are the ones that last the longest in the pro sports? I tell them, I go, look across every pro sport in the world, football, baseball, basketball, American football. And I go, it's the ones that hustle. It's not the ones with the most talent. It's the one that goes in and grinds day in and day out. Because over time, their talent emerges. But they're the ones that are hardest working. They're outworking everyone around them. And I go, bud, that's the only thing you can do. I go, that translates not just to the pitch, but to everything else in your life. Yeah. If you're willing to put the effort in and grind and work hard, everything else will rise to the top around you. And that's why I think my approach as a parent is I can't tell them how to play soccer anymore because I know what the right decision is with 180-degree view. I don't have his 70-degree cone that he gets at the soccer field. If he's scanning well, that 70-degree cone might be now 100 degrees, but it's still not a huge view of the soccer, of the pitch. And I get what you're saying. It's like we can't suck the fun out of it. And I think it's like I always ask my daughter, like, what do you want? Like you said, you ask your kids what you want to do, and I'll do whatever they ask me to do. And my daughter is convinced she always has to play soccer with me because I'm obsessed with the game. And she wants me to sit there and watch her do her gymnastics. We'll sit there and watch her do her gymnastics. We'll see how many back bends you can do in a row, or show me what you're learning that you can do on your own here at the house. And I think I know I'm guilty of it, is that I'm very much soccer focused, and so my kids think that's quality time with me. Quality time is not the soccer. It's
You can only imagine how it is from my end as well, because I actually have an older son who's not particularly interested at all. Just not out of, I didn't get in his way or anything like that. It was the same approach. It was just, he likes other stuff. And when the little one's gone to bed, we'll watch Mr. Beast together, or we'll, do you know what I mean? We'll do other things and go to Cub Scouts and all that sort of stuff. That's fine. That's just parenting, isn't it? You know, what we've got, Ian, and I've said this recently as well, and it slaps you in the face, is that we're talking about the most popular game in the world. Right, bar none, regardless of what some of your audience might think, like worldwide, it's a simple fact. It is so difficult to get in the way of that. How hard must you need to work to stop a kid loving playing the most popular game in the world? And that goes for a coach or a parent. I think it's a really important place to start from. I'm a big believer in reading the room. When, if you're, as a parent or a coach, if you're reading a room and your analysis of that room says, I'm boring them, I'm taking the intensity of all this over the top. You can impart as much advice to whoever you want, but if they're not listening, it's probably better to keep your mouth shut. You know what I mean? And just follow their lead instead. So yeah, but it's complex. And for every A, there will be a Z. For every case study you make, someone else will go, oh, but that player made it. He doesn't have any hustle. That player made it. They don't have any hustle. That player made it out of... But there, that's the game. That's the vastness of it. And yeah, if our idea is to get our kid to the top of the game from the start of the journey, my goodness, that's set up to fail. I would, that is like a roulette wheel. And there might be one red on it. So no one would take that bet. But what we can do is teach him to love it and get better and enjoy and play one versus one with my lad outside. And I don't always win. He doesn't always win. I can, at the moment, I can control these kind of things. But I can make sure he dribbles at me, and I can make sure I praise him when he uses his other foot, and I can make sure I praise him when he runs like hell to stop me scoring. I can praise all those things, and kids grow from that praise. They want to do it again. We know that. Every parent knows that. So I figure if I want my kids to be good at something, give them the conditions to go do it, and then praise them for doing it, and let's see if it starts repeating. And that goes for in a coaching session as well.
I think as a parent, we'll switch over to coaching here in a few, but as parents, I think, like you talked about praising, I think it's so important for us to make sure that they know that they're loved and they're appreciated what they're doing. And like you said, your oldest is not into soccer, but you make the time, you're parenting them as the individual. And I think as parents, it's like when my son was younger, we had a lot of fun. And now there's moments like he needs to go work on his set pieces because he takes majority of his team's set pieces. And I'm like, but if you want to continue doing this, you have to work on it. I go, we don't have to spend the next hour doing it. We need to take 10, 15 shots. And we can go do whatever you want after that. We'll go do whatever you want for 10 to 15 minutes. We'll go take those 10 shots and we can go do whatever you want. I'm not asking him to go spend an hour doing it ever. I'm just asking you to spend 5 minutes doing the one thing that you need to work on, and then we can go have all the fun you want. And you can mix it in. And it's because he tells me what his goals are, and I think we have to listen to our kids. And I think sometimes we project our own vision of their goals onto our kids. But at the same time, my son has been telling me since he's been 5 that he wants to be a professional soccer player that plays in the Champions League. He doesn't know what club he wants to play for, but he wants to play for a club that plays in the Champions League. At 5 years old, I had no clue the Champions League when he was 5. So I had to go Google this and research it and understand what this was. And his goal has never changed. His interests over time have expanded.
For sure.
But his love for the game is steady. And my biggest fear as a parent is driving that love out of the game. And the best advice I was given, and it was, I've shared this story many times now, and it's talking about teaching him how to communicate better with me. Not my wife, but me as his parent. And for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe it was longer, maybe it was shorter, I don't remember now. But I just rode him. Every time we got in the car, I started to ride him and ride him. But I always started off the conversation, when you're done talking about this, let me know. And finally 1 week, because Dad, he told me to shut up. He really didn't tell me to shut up. He just told me, I can't talk about this anymore. And he goes, I go, bud. And I turned around and I said, thank you. And he goes, why are you thanking me? And he's 9 years old, by the way, when I'm doing this to him. I go, I was riding you so hard, I wanted you to know that you can tell me to be quiet And like, we had a whole deep conversation about it, about how we don't always have to talk about soccer, that you can talk about whatever you want to talk about and be happy about talking about it. And that it's a safe place to say, I don't want to talk about this as much as I might want to, but it's your environment that you have to be in. And I think we as parents need to set up an environment where our kids feel safe and our athletes feel safe not to say that to us. It's like, I don't want to talk about this. I'm going to practice. I'm going to deal with it then. And I'm going to deal with it at the game. I'm going to deal with it there. And I truly believe the car ride home and the car ride to a game is the killer.
Yeah, there's a best. There's a best. As you were talking there, there's a best version and a worst version of all those things, isn't there? And I think, look, if you surround, if you constantly surround something, anything in negativity, that's what it becomes. So if it's just, it's quite interesting. I do the program you spoke about joining. I do a professional coach version of that. We had a sports psychologist come on this week talking about the Positive Coaching Alliance, which is obviously a US-based group. I'm not exactly sure how it's formed or whatever, but the idea that if you want the criticism you've got of someone to be heard and to land well, it needs to be wrapped up with five pieces of positivity. Now, not all at once, right? So to me, that translates to over time, if I can have a much healthier balance between praise and strengths-based coaching, then, you know, when I've really got to tell you something about your whatever, your free kicks that your son is taking or your the runs he has to do or whatever it might be, then that's easier to land. It's easier to accept. And this isn't just kid stuff now. This is people. So your boss at work, if your boss at work is always riding you and you feel a negative atmosphere around it all the time, if everything is a problem or the only things you speak about or get feedback about are problems, that's pretty rotten, isn't it? And I hate for sport atmospheres to end up like that under the cover of standards. We've high standards here, so you can't do that. Jurgen Klopp once said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, I can shout at you because I love you. And I can berate you in front of the world, but you'll trust me because we have a body of work over time where you can trust me. And I think that's a massive message for youth coaches because if we all go to training and games and think that the stereotypical environment should be hostile, negative, nitpicky, negative feedback, shouting, all that sort of stuff, I think we missed a trick. I think we've seen the headline, but not the formation of all this, which is good relationships, trust, them believing you actually have their best interests at heart, not just your own interests, your own ego as a parent. Using yours as an example is, if I'm upset with my son's hustle, is it because of my ego? Because other parents can see my son not making that recovery run or going that, chasing that ball that he's never going to get anyway, all that sort of stuff. It's quite controllable rather than a technical error, for example. Yeah, I'd like to feel that in my environments where I would work, even at the highest level with international players, that people come into the building smiling and people know if there's been a problem or if you've got something that needs work on, you can take that away and work on it without prejudice, without anything. It's just something we do, and especially for kids.
I talked about trust, and there's a certain circumstance that happened this past year in the March Madness in the collegiate basketball season. And the coach goes off on the player during the game, gets in her face, screaming and yelling at the player. And a sports psychiatrist or a sports mental toughness coach got on and says, they're turning in their chips. All those years, all those months, however long this player's been playing with that coach, they're turning in their trust chips that day. And it was, in that moment, the player wouldn't take it personal because they truly trust the coach. And I think that's the difference that I'm seeing a paradigm shift happening in our youth sports, talking to coaches. We're getting away from what I call the American football coach, but we're also getting to the point where players are trusting their coaches more. And maybe not the parents don't trust the coach, but the players trust the coach. And I think you talked about it, all those, I don't remember who it was, he just said, about turning in his trust. And I think we as parents have to look at it that way. There's a coach I know here, and I talk to him on a regular basis. That's what I love doing. And he goes, yeah, I ride my girls in practice, but at the same time, if something happens on the pitch, I'm going to bat for them. And they know that I will do whatever it is to protect them. I'm a loud vocal person. It's just who I am. And but he goes, but at the same time, they know that I will praise them when they do well. I will be their biggest cheerleader off the pitch and on the pitch. And I've gained their trust. And when I am, I'm loud and vocal. He goes, I'm not for everyone. Yeah. But they all know that I have their back. Yeah.
I saw that clip. I'm pretty sure it's the same clip that kind of went viral of the female coach and the female player. Yeah, and it was when I first saw it, I thought, oh, goodness me. It looks horrific in isolation. Then you get the backstory to it. What worries me with stuff like that, especially when stuff like that goes viral, it gives permission for the outer context. That is, oh, we've celebrated that in isolation. Oh, sorry, we've celebrated that moment based on all the context around it. But how does that translate to impressionable coaches or developing coaches who've seen that and go, I should do that. That's considered good coaching and probably considered, I don't know if I want to say the word easy, but I could find some things to holler at people and get a reaction out of them. I could find anything at any given moment. But without the depth that situation provided, it's vastly different. And look, that's where coach development comes in. That's where coach education comes in. That's where experience comes in. That's where understanding your context. If you're translating that to your under eights on a wet Sunday morning, it probably doesn't hit. It definitely doesn't hit.
It goes back to what you said. It's about reading the room, and you just talked about age. I think doing that at a professional level versus a bunch of eight-year-olds is a huge thing. I associate it with officiating, being a ref on a field. Will I allow a ball that hits a kid's elbow or maybe forearm when they're running to be called a handball? Probably not if I'm reffing a game. At a U19 game, more than likely I'm going to call that a handball. They know better. It's about reading the room, reading the environment you're in, or even a high-level rec game, an older age group. I shouldn't say a high-level rec game, an older age group in a rec game. It's being mindful for where you're at. So if you, instead of being screaming at the player, you bring them over and you have a little chat, maybe you're a little bit more firm with them and you let them go on their way. It doesn't have to be a full-out screaming match between the player and the coach. It is, or at the player, it's reading the room and the age. And I think we as parents, I'm not saying all, but I've been guilty of this. I expect this professional level out of my 12-year-old. Yeah. And that's not realistic. I need to expect a 12-year-old level, maybe a year older, out of him.
And look, to be honest with you, there's probably every cross-section of type of player in between. There's a professional player that will have played hundreds and hundreds of professional games, World Cups, that would hit the roof if their coach did that to him publicly, him or her publicly. They would hit the roof. There would be violence in the changing room after that. There would be, because it's knowing individuals, it's knowing your players, it's knowing how much credit you have in the bank. It's doing it for the right reasons. The reason I heard it, and I don't know how much this stuck, I think I probably saw it a couple of times and that was it, was that it was snapping her out of some sort of, I don't know, spiral or whatever. So I'm not sure the science on that, but it fit. It seemed to fit. Whereas in many ways it wouldn't. And look, but I think that's also the beauty of it. That sounds really difficult, but that's also the beauty of it. You know what I mean? And maybe as a coach, you make a mistake, but don't make it again if that's the case. I've had parents come to me saying, I really wish you would be harsher on my kid. And you go, okay. And then you have other parents that come to you and say, oh, well, you said that to him last week. What did you mean? And it might have been really insignificant to you. People are messy, right? People are messy, and people's personalities and all that are messy. Coaching's messy. Soccer is exceptionally messy, right? And navigating our way through it with best practice is probably the best way.
Today's conversation with Ray highlights the importance the environment around youth player really is, from coaching style to parents' behavior to how we define success in youth sports. One of the biggest takeaways for me was understanding that development is messy, growth takes time, and sometimes the best things adults can do is stop trying to control every moment and simply help the kids stay connected to the game. Big thanks to Ray for joining me today.
This podcast, I've enjoyed what I've been trying to do, the messages that I'm putting out there. Please give me some ratings, some stars on all the podcast sites that you listen to this on. Give me a review, share this, share with others. The more I can make this grow, the more I can continue doing this. I'm really trying to make a difference in our soccer community. So I hope you guys have enjoyed all this. And until next time, I'll see you at the pitch.